Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tony Giddens, the director of the LSE. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all here this afternoon and to extend a particular welcome to the school, to Mr. Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the United Nations. And naturally, I can't exaggerate how pleased we are that you found time to come to visit the LSE. Using his charm, gentle powers of persuasion, and the unequaled legitimacy of his position, Kofi Annan has become universally regarded as an honest broker among world leaders, winning the respect of everyone, from Colonel Gaddafi to Jesse Helms. He has done an enormous amount to restore the reputation of the United Nations. Thanks to his commitment to budgetary, administrative, and strategic reform, the United Nations has been transformed from an organization sometimes seen as bureaucratic and hollow into a pioneer of new forms of governance through alliances between nations, corporations, NGOs, and other groups. Jointly with the United Nations, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for rising to new challenges, such as those presented by HIV/AIDS, and for bringing new vigor to the organization to which he has devoted his entire working life. I believe this is his first visit to the London School of Economics, but we're doubly pleased to have him here because the LSE has a long history of collaboration with the United Nations. And when I visited the United Nations recently, I was quite amazed to see the number of LSE alumni who have penetrated almost all levels of the organization. In conjunction with this, I'd just like to mention that the LSE and Columbia University are organizing a State of the Planet conference on May 13 and 14 in New York City as part of the lead-up to the Johannesburg Summit. Well, ladies and gentlemen, now please give Mr. Kofi Annan a very warm LSE welcome.
Thank you very, very much. That was a very warm welcome. If you keep doing this, I will stay here. Thank you, Professor Giddens, for that very kind introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honor for me to speak at the London School of Economics, which counts amongst its alumni so many heroes of the struggle for independence and for development in former colonial world, including Kwame Nkrumah, the founding president of my own country. What I want to speak to you about this afternoon is essentially the continuation of that struggle. Independence was achieved, but development has been very uneven, especially in Africa, which since independence has fallen sadly behind some other parts of the developing world. I do not need to describe for you the multiple hardships to which so many of our fellow human beings are subjected, each of which makes it harder to escape from the others. Poverty, hunger, disease, oppression, conflict, pollution, and depletion of natural resources. Development means enabling people to escape from that vicious cycle. Like the struggle for independence, the struggle for development has been carried on and has to be carried on mainly in developing countries and by their people. Its first prerequisites are basic security, the rule of law, honest, transparent administration, which only national governments can provide. But it is a struggle that concerns the world as a whole. Developed countries like this one have a strong interest in the outcome, both in whether development succeeds and in what form it takes. They can also do much to influence the outcome. It is to institutions like this Center for the Study of Good Global Governance that we look to for intellectual leadership. LSE can play a part in this struggle, no less important than its part in the previous one. 18 months ago, at the Millennium Summit in New York, world leaders reached agreement on some immediate targets, the Millennium Development Goals, for halving extreme poverty in the world by 2015 by tackling both its worst symptoms and its most obstinate causes. Those goals are ambitious, but even if we achieve them, the struggle will not be won. There will still be hundreds of millions of people lacking the minimum requirements of human dignity. There will still be a great deal to be done. And as I was saying, it will all be in vain if the achievement cannot be sustained. So it is equally important that we achieve another goal set by the world leaders at the Millennium Summit. And let me quote, to free humanity, or to free all of humanity, and above all our children and grandchildren, from the threat of living on a planet irredeemably spoiled by human activities and whose resources would no longer be sufficient for their needs. I believe success depends on the answers to three global questions, each of them associated particularly with one of the three international conferences referred to in the title of my lecture. The first question is, will men and women in the developing world be allowed to compete on fair terms in the global market? That question received the beginning, but only the beginning, of a positive answer at last November's meeting of the World Trade Organization in Doha. The second question is, how can we mobilize the resources so desperately needed for development? That question will be discussed next month at the International Conference on Financing for Development in Monterrey, Mexico. And the third question is a more complex one. Can the people now living on this planet improve their lives, not at the expense of future generations, but in a way from which their children and grandchildren will benefit? That, of course, will be the issue at the World Summit on Sustainable Development that begins in Johannesburg 6 months from tomorrow. The three questions are clearly interrelated, and the conferences should be seen as a continuum, not isolated events. Poor people in poor countries are not asking for a handout. They want a hand up. And I repeat, they want a hand up. Indeed, the poor are enormous untapped reservoir of initiative and entrepreneurship. But their energies are often held in check by poverty, misrule, and conflict. They would be the first to say that trade, not aid, is the path out of poverty. That's why it is so important that we fulfill the promise of Doha, the promise of a development round of trade negotiations, which will remove the unfair subsidies now given to producers in the rich countries and fully open the markets of those countries to labor-intensive exports from the developing ones. Not only do these subsidies make it impossible for developing countries to compete, they also do great damage to the rich countries themselves by perpetuating unsustainable practices in farming, transport, and energy use. Powerful interest groups within the rich countries will try hard to block meaningful concessions to the developing world. They will argue that the interests of workers and farmers are being sacrificed. But there are other ways to help those groups that really need help, ways less costly to consumers and taxpayers in the rich countries and less harmful to producers of poor ones. To fulfill the promise of Doha, political and business leaders in the developed world must rise above special pleading and narrow sectorial interest. However, even if developed countries were to declare their markets fully open, developing countries will still need help in walking through the door. Many small and poor countries do not attract investment, not because they are badly governed or have unfriendly policies, but simply because they are too small and poor to be interesting market or to become major producers, and because they lack the skills, infrastructure, and institutions that a successful market needs. The unpleasant truth is that markets put a premium on success and tend to punish the poor for the very fact of being poor. At Monterey, leaders from North and South, presidents, finance ministers, the United Nations, the Bretton Woods institutions, and NGOs, and heads of private companies and foundations will come together to discuss creative, practical ways of overcoming this market failure. They will address issues crucial to the fight against poverty and the transition to sustainability, such as debt relief, commodity prices, and the management of the global economy. They will seek ways to tap private investment, which is a far bigger source of money for development than official development assistance will ever be. The question is how to tap it with the right mix of incentive, policies, and partnerships. But I hope the leaders of industrialized countries will also give new commitments of official aid, as Gordon Brown, for one, has so eloquently urged. I saw him today, and he is determined to press on. I know that simply writing off debt or giving away any particular sum of money will not guarantee results, and that taxpayers in some rich countries have become wary of foreign aid as a general proposition. But I have found they are almost invariably responsive when you present them with a major human problem and a credible strategy for dealing with it, as I think we are beginning to do with the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Our greatest challenge is to show that these problems are part of an even bigger problem, the problem of global poverty and underdevelopment. Islands of treatment are a vital start, but we must also address a larger sea of misery. There is a global deal on the table. Developing countries doing more to reform their economies and increase spending on the needs of the poor, while the rich countries support this with trade, aid, investment, and debt relief. At Monterey, let's clinch that deal. The World Summit on Sustainable Development is not, as some people think, simply another conference on the global environment. The whole idea of sustainable development, reflected in the Rio Air Summit 10 years ago, is that environment and development are inextricably linked. Much was achieved at Rio. Agenda 21 adopted there remains as visionary today as it was then, and local authorities and civil societies in almost every part of the world have been working to implement it. Moreover, the legally binding Convention on Climate Change, Biodiversity, and Desertification have been added since then, as well as action plans adopted at the United Nations conferences throughout the 90s. Now brought together in the Millennium Development Goals. And yet, there is a feeling of loss of momentum. As our attention has been focused on conflict, on globalization, or most recently on terrorism, we have often failed to see how these are connected to the issue of sustainability. That word has become a pious invocation rather than the urgent call to concrete action that it should be. Prevailing approaches for development remain fragmented and piecemeal. Funding is woefully inadequate, and production and consumption patterns continue to overburden the world's natural life support systems. Sustainable development may be the new conventional wisdom, but many people have still not grasped its meaning. One important task at Johannesburg is to show that it is far from being as abstract as it sounds. It is a life or death issue for millions upon millions of people and potentially the whole human race. Let me try to put a human face on it. One of them might be that of a woman in a rural district. It could be India or almost anywhere in Africa, who year by year finds she has to go further and further to search for water and fuel. Her back aches from long journey, carrying heavy load, but her heart aches even more from the fear that failure will expose herself and her children to hunger, thirst, and disease. How much longer can her way of life be sustained? Another face might be that of a son or a cousin of that woman, who precisely because the rural way of life was no longer sustainable for a growing population, is now living in an urban slum or shanty town. He has no work, or rather, he lacks the training and resources needed to start work, though his community desperately needs the contribution he could make. What's worse, although he himself does not know it, he's infected with HIV/AIDS and has passed it on to his wife. How much longer can this way of life be sustained? A third phase might be that of someone who looks much better off than the first two. He lives in a house or an apartment, owns a car, and has a job in one of the rapidly growing East Asian cities. But at this moment, he's been sitting in that car for an hour, and it is not moving. He's eager to get home to his wife and children, but he's stuck among thousands like himself, all pounding on their horns and still running their engines. He also has respiratory disease caused by toxic chemicals in the factory where he works, and his children suffer from asthma. He wants to get away from this environment, and he's saving money to pay for false travel documents so that he can join his brother in Europe or North America. What he does not realize is that his way of life, when he gets there, may not be very different. The more development follows this pattern, the less sustainable it is going to be in any part of the world. Indeed, the fourth phase may be that of any one of us in this room. We lead immensely privileged lives compared to the vast majority of our fellow human beings. But we do so by consuming so much more than our share of the Earth's resources and by leaving a much larger footprint of waste and pollution on the global environment. Moreover, our way of life is highly visible to many who cannot share it, but who see it as a glamorized form on flickering screens in those slums and shanty towns. It is, one could say, flaunted before them as the model of development to which they could aspire. But is it sustainable? And if so, for how many people? Certainly not in its present form, for all the 6 billion who already inhabit this planet, let alone the 9 or 12 or 15 billion who will inhabit it, depending on which scenario you adopt in the decades to come. Our way of life has to change. But how and how fast? Agenda 21 and all that flows from it can be said to have given us the how, to have given us the what. What the problem is, what principles must guide our response. Johannesburg must give us the how to bring about the necessary changes in state policy, how to use policy and tax incentives to send the right signals to business and industry, how to offer better choices to individual consumers and producers, how in the end to get it done. Far from being a burden, sustainable development is an exceptional opportunity economically to build markets and create jobs, socially to bring people in from the margins, and politically to reduce tensions over resources that could lead to violence and to give every man and woman a voice and a choice in deciding their own future. One thing we have learned over the years is that neither doom and gloom scenarios nor destructive criticism will inspire people and governments to act. What is needed is a positive vision, a clear roadmap from getting from here to there, and a clear responsibility assigned to each of the many actors in the system. Johannesburg must give us that vision, a vision of a global system in which every country has a place and a share in its benefits. And it must give us all a clear sense of our share in the task. As Tony Blair said, there is no answer to any of these problems except one based on mutual responsibility. Governments have their responsibilities, but so too do corporations, civil society groups, and private individuals. I hope at Johannesburg we shall see them all come together in a new coalition, a coalition for responsible prosperity. In an era of rapid change, it must mark a break with business as usual. In an era of great wealth, it must show how wealth can be shared by those living and preserved for those who come after. And in an era of insecurity, it must offer the prospect of peace through hope. Hope that life tomorrow would be better, safer, fairer, more enjoyable than it is today. Ladies and gentlemen, will these three conferences, Doha, Monterey, Johannesburg, find a place in the history books? It depends on us. If we do not fulfill their promise, they will disappear in the driest of footnotes. But I like to think that they will merit a chapter in themselves, a chapter that can be summarized like this. Challenged by the goals of his political leaders that met at the Millennium Summit, and shocked into stronger sense of common destiny by the horror of 11 September 2001. During the following 12 months, the human race at last summon the will to tackle the really tough issues facing it. In passionate debates held in the meeting rooms and corridors of three great world assemblies, it painstakingly assembled the tools, thrashed out the strategies, and formed the creative partnerships that were needed to do the job. That's what I should like to read 15 years from now. Let us resolve to make it come true. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Secretary General. That was a splendid speech. It reminded me of something that Mahbub ul Haq, who gave a lot of his life to UN, once said. The sustainable development is a question of quality of life for the rich countries, but it's a question of life for the poor countries. And we have to remember that. And we are very, very grateful that you have actually made us aware of the really serious problems the world faces, rather than just those that which make the headlines. Now, before I take questions, and there's time for a few questions, let me make a pre-announcement, which is that when this question-answer session is over, would you please remain seated in your seats while the Secretary General and the people on the platform can go out. After that, people can move around. Now, I invite questions about the lecture. I hope. Who would like to ask questions? Let's take four or five questions at once. Gentlemen in the back there. Hang on, are there mics?
There should be roving mics for everybody.
The roving mic.
Around the room.
Yes.
Can you please not put it too close to your mouth, sort of a little way down? That's the way.
Secretary General, thank you very much for a wonderful talk. I speak as someone myself born in Africa, born in Burundi and brought up in Kenya. And I'm so glad you mentioned what is a hot potato. And the thing about the LSE is that we are prepared, I hope, to tackle hot potatoes, but you only just mentioned it. And that's the hot potato of population, of human numbers. You mentioned it in the way that so often it is mentioned by economists and sociologists as a kind of constant to which we must somehow try to adapt, rather than something amenable to voluntary, non-coercive modification. There are 80 million extra people, as you know, coming on the planet every year at the moment, and we could go up to 15 billion, as you say. And if all of them, the only way out of poverty is development, and development must be done by damaging the environment, mustn't it? You've got to have a minimum amount of energy consumption and pollution and resource consumption. With 3 billion people already needing that help, and 80 million a year arriving, also almost all needing that help, how can we do it?
Thank you,
Secretary General, without implementing the Cairo agenda. And let's have more money. Cairo called for $17 billion a year to go to reproductive health. Will the UN make sure that this happens? It's only $5 billion at the moment. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Could I request people to keep their questions short? gentlemen there at the back. Can a mic come down in the middle here? Because I'm going to take the next question over here.
Thank you. We find ourselves trapped in the notion that it's the responsibility of the rich countries to help finance development in the poor world. And yet, in the face of major global environmental problems like climate change, the severity of global disturbance of the atmosphere actually posits the situation that we might be living in a phase at the end of human development. We've seen how a single extreme weather event can put back social development in, say, Central America by 3 or 4 decades. I'd just like to ask a question about whether we can move forward without acknowledging the fact that rather than the rich countries financing development in the poor countries, it's actually the poor countries through lending us their environmental space who finance development in the rich countries. And if we were to put a price tag on that, we'd see that the kind of flows of concessional resources going to developing countries from the rich world are a tiny fraction of a percent of the way in which it's the developing world who have been supporting our lifestyles.
Good, thank you very much. One more question in the middle here. Gentleman there. Thank you.
Hello, Secretary General David Bull from UNICEF. There was one other conference which should have taken place last September but was delayed, unfortunately, by the events of September the 11th and will now be happening in May, the UN General Assembly Special Session on Children. And I wonder how that fits into this journey around the world which you've described and the role which our young people must play if the future vision which you've painted for us is to become a reality. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you want to take those three questions, Anil?
Yes, I will. Let me, on the question of reproductive health, I think you are quite right that it is essential that we control the population growth. And I think we've also noticed that there is a direct correlation between the level of development and the rate of population growth. And the more societies develop and open up, you would notice a drop in the population rate. And therefore, we should really be intensifying those efforts. You are asking me if the money will be available, if the UN can raise the money, but the UN is a member state. And in fact, the discussions that we are having in my own contacts with leaders, almost on any of these issues, apart from sensible plans, apart from the poor countries making the efforts to have the right institutions, strengthen the institutions, have the right regulatory system, and creating the right environment, we have appealed to the developing world to also make the developed world to make its contribution, whether it's AIDS, whether it's health and development, whatever it is, or population control, additional resources are needed. And this is one of the important aspects of the conference we are going to have in Monterey, where Gordon Brown, for example, has indicated we should try and set up a Millennium Fund, which will require $50 billion a day to tackle some of the issues a year, $50 billion a year. You were very polite. Nobody reacted to $50 billion a day until I corrected myself. That would be
Gordon.
Nice if we...
We know Gordon. You know,
$50 billion a year. Of course, this would be a collective effort. I don't imply that it must all come from the United Kingdom, so you taxpayers don't get overly worked up about it. But it will take resources, and the resources will have to come from government. We can play the advocacy role. We can work with governments to understand the issues, but the money will have to come from the government, and you here in this hall can be good advocates in explaining the issue and getting governments and policymakers to respond. On the question of responsibility of the rich for the poor, I think you make a good point. And by the way, let me say that I think there has been a shift. No one in the development business or the UN today is insisting that the rich is entirely responsible for the poor, and the poor need not have to make an effort. In fact, we are encouraging and working with the poor to make their own contributions, to take a look at their own societies, and to create an enabling environment that will release the creative energies of their own population with the help, with the North or with the developed countries helping in. But I think on the question you raised about consumption and the price tag that could be put on the space of the poor, I could agree with you, but how do we get policymakers and governments to accept that proposition? I think it is a real issue, and in fact, when you attend these conferences from Doha to some of the meetings that we are going to hold, today I'm not sure any government is going to be ready to accept that responsibility, but it is something that we need to look at. And I think as we look at the consumption patterns and we begin to question the environment and the threat it poses for all of us, we will need to put greater value on it, not just in the developing world, but even in the North and the way we
exploiting the resources of the earth in an unsustainable manner. On the Children's Summit, yes, it will be in May. The preparations are going ahead in New York. We expect to have quite a few heads of states attending that meeting. And I think UNICEF has done a great job preparing the conference and raising awareness. And what I'm talking about affects the children perhaps the most. We are talking about the future. We are talking about the leaders of the 21st century. How do we prepare them in terms of education, in terms of giving them healthy lives, making sure that we leave them a healthy planet? So the children fit in very much here. If I did not mention them, I did not intend to imply that they are irrelevant in the scheme of things. In fact, they are at the center of it and should be seen as such. And on occasions like this, I like to quote an African proverb which says that the earth is not ours. It's a treasure we hold in trust for our children and their children. I hope our generation will be worthy of that trust. Sometimes I wonder. Thank you.
Very good. Yes. 1, 2, 3. Can you bring it down here? The lady there.
So far they've been very disciplined. They've stuck to the lecture.
That's good.
Hello.
Yes.
Secretary General, I was at the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, and one of the comments you made there was the importance of the new global civil society, which was very evident in Durban. And one of the things I observed in Durban was the way in which civil society, especially with the help of South Africa and their experience, to some extent started taking over the conference at lots of different levels. The meeting that's happening in Johannesburg will not have the same facilities that we had in Durban. How can you ensure that civil society has the same ability to negotiate and to relate to the leaders in Johannesburg that we had in Durban?
Okay. The lady there, and then the gentleman there in a minute, yeah.
Hello, Secretary General. You described the routes to sustainable development via Doha and the free international trade. But do you believe we can really ever reach sustainable development or achieve sustainable development by a path that involves more and more transport of goods and resources around the globe and so contributes to climate change?
Tony Benn. Mike is coming to you.
Secretary General, you spoke of your work in a post-colonial period. But is it not a fact the greatest empire the world has ever known is now growing, has set out as its objective full spectrum dominance of land, sea, air and information, is engaged in a massive rearmament program and has announced its intention to change the regimes of some countries by force? How does that fit in with the development project that you have in mind?
Gentlemen there.
Thank you, Secretary General. I was going to ask a similar question more directly, which was, how do you deal with the America problem? In your tour from Doha to Johannesburg, you're full of hope, and I think we all have to have hope. But to make that hope a reality, we've got to have some change of heart in the United States. In the preparations for Monterey, there doesn't seem to have been a new opening up. There doesn't seem to have been that dawning of realization that you hoped for in your press release. Their delegates to the PrepCom for Monterey were hermetically sealed to any prospect of further debt relief, to fairer trade, and to levering up their miserable aid to the third world. How do you feel that the rest of the world has to relate to the United States? How do you see your role in enabling us to enable the United States to become less introverted, more open and generous to the rest of the world?
Thank you. The lady up there.
Thank you. Secretary General, I wanted to ask, first of all, thank you very much for your talk. And secondly,
What, if any, is the UN's support to the NEPAD initiative by African governments and African states? And do you think that they can go it alone, that if there is no support from outside, can African countries go alone? Thank you.
And lastly, the gentleman there, and then I'll pass it on to the Secretary.
Secretary General, thank you for your very inspiring address. For those of us who are at the World Trade Organization ministerial meeting in Doha, I think we would say that the starting point for this journey perhaps gives cause for concern. What we saw was the rich countries there, not only the United States, but also the European Union, were pressing ahead with their own agenda while using a rhetoric of development, but frankly, out of Doha, what emerged was an agenda that was profoundly in the interests of the European Union and the US, and actually made no progress on making trade rules fairer to the poor. There is in this campaign, in this country, a campaign starting up called the Trade Justice Movement, which we anticipate will involve many thousands of people to campaign for fairer trade rules. What advice could you give people in the North about ways to use their influence in order to make your agenda happen? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. On the issue of civil society, you've posed a question of from Durban to Johannesburg, and if civil society will have the same influence, the same power in Johannesburg as it did in Durban, and if the conference is structured in a manner that will allow their voice to be heard. I think the conference will be structured in a manner that the voices of all stakeholders, civil society, the private sector, foundations and others, and governments and international organizations will be heard. But I hope we will not see what happened in Durban happen. You yourself said civil society almost took over the conference. We're going there to exchange ideas, we're going there to discuss a common problem and work together on a common program. And I hope we will all come with an open approach and not determination by one group or the other to take over. And the governments and the international organizations must be open. And they must be open to the inputs and advice from civil society and others. And I think if we all work together, we will have a very, I hope, a successful conference. On trade, the question has been posed if it would be viable to keep producing goods and transporting them around the globe and not harm the environment. But I think this is also one of the areas where we've all talked about the green revolution and the fact that we should be able to come up with approaches that will not pollute the air as much as we would want to. On the other hand, we have to be quite honest. If we do not move goods around, take food for example, there are parts of the world which is not able to feed itself. There are parts in the developing world which does quite a lot of trade in commodities and other. They should be able to move them out. The question is not moving out the goods, but how you move them out and what means you use and what sort of transport and equipment and what type of technology you develop in the future, so that you don't keep on polluting the environment. And I think this is where we challenge scientists to come up with more green technology. And in the developing world, if I may add, I also challenge the scientists to come up with other sources of energy and sources of energy for the poor, so that they don't have to cut the trees to warm their water and to cook and all that. On the question of the U.S. policy, I think I had two questions. One from Honorable Ben, Tony Ben, and the other question about how we can influence the U.S. policy. Let me say that I don't speak for Washington. I represent the United Nations, and our approach and policies are often quite different. Take the issue of Iraq, which you, in a way you alluded to. My mandate as Secretary General of the UN is to help oversee implementation of Security Council resolutions. On Iraq, the Security Council position is clear. Iraq must disarm, and if it fails to disarm, economic sanctions will remain in place. There is nothing in the resolution that talks about using military force to get Iraq to comply. If the Security Council were ever to take that kind of decision, then it would be my problem to deal with it. I'm on record as saying that I personally believe that it would be unwise for the U.S. to attack Iraq at this stage. The question has been raised as to how, what I can do and the rest of us can do to influence U.S. Policy and U.S. approach to debt relief and aid. I think it's a question of engaging them. It's a question of dialogue, and lots of governments are talking to the U.S. There are discussions going on between Europe and the U.S., and I'm talking to policymakers in Washington. There is a question of how do you increase development assistance. The U.S. has proposed 50% of World Bank loans should be converted into grants. Other governments are worried about this idea because they believe it will deplete the resources of the bank, which has been given concessionary loans to governments, and the payments rates are very high. They keep repaying the debt, so it replenishes itself. If you give the loans away, at or 50% of it away, will the governments keep replenishing their World Bank coffers, or we will allow the World Bank to run out of money and eventually shut down? So there is a debate going on. Some governments, I hope at Monterey, will announce major new initiatives and increases in their development assistance and challenge others to do the same thing. I hope the U.S. Would also be there with concrete proposals. President Bush has indicated he is coming to the conference, which is good news because it is an important conference. What specifically they will put on the table on the aid issue and some of the other issues at the conference, I cannot say, but we will have to wait and see what happens. But what I can assure you is that there's quite a lot of discussions going on and attempts to work together and to influence each other in the positive and constructive way. On the issue of NEPAD, let me say that the UN and I personally have been working with the African governments and also working with the G8. The G8 launched the NEPAD proposals in Genoa with the invitation to five African leaders who attended the meeting. But I have also reminded the G8 and Canada, which is carrying the ball forward, that when it comes to development of Africa and focus on African development, we have to be careful not to create the impression that it's an issue for the G8 alone. There are governments outside the G8 which are much more generous. The Scandinavian countries, the Netherlands and other that we need to pull in. And I think that is happening. What the UN has done is to offer the facilities and the capabilities of the Economic Commission for Africa to do the technical work and work with the African leaders and the G8 group in preparing concrete ideas for moving the NEPAD forward. And I do welcome the emphasis on Africa and the attempts by the leaders to work jointly to improve economic conditions and the lot of the African people. The last question was the issue of Doha, where the rich press their agenda. And the participant, our questioner, had the sense that they were paying lip service to the needs of the poor. I think those who have privileges and advantages do not always give it up easily. You often have to pressure them to do it. And I think the developing countries themselves, I think, are this time better organized than they were in Uruguay around. I think they are going to be insisting on implementation of some of the agreements of Uruguay as well as the new proposals on the table. I hope your group Justice for the Movement for Trade Justice can also add its voice, and there are other influential people who can add their voice to this. And we need to get the message around, and I hope 11 September drove it home to us that we cannot be indifferent to problems in other regions of the world and that it may come back to haunt us. I think if when the Russians left in 1989, we had paid attention to Afghanistan and really heard them come up to stand up their economy and done a bit of nation building, a phrase which is not always popular, we probably would not have lived through the nightmare and the anxiety that we are all going through now. And I think it is important that we take steps and assist nations in order not to, if not for anything else, not to create future Afghanistans. But I think the question of the trade is an important one, and whatever you can do to support open, fair, and free trade would be helpful. But it also means, as I said, getting the developed countries to remove the subsidies that they pay their own producers. In fact, there is a statistic, I don't know if it's true, that the subsidy that the European Union pays its farmers is enough to fly every cow in Europe first class around the world. And have it, you know. But,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I know lots of more people want to ask questions, but time is up. I have to thank the Secretary General for not only a very, very good, interesting, and profound speech, which you will find on the Global Dimensions website, www.globaldimensions.net, but also for answering questions with great patience and thoroughness. All I have to say is thank you so very much for coming to London School of Economics. We are an institution not only, as our motto says, to know the causes of things, but we have been since our establishment dedicated to solving problems of poverty as well. And let's hope that we can make our own contribution to the challenge we have posed before us. Thank you all very much. Thank you. You've been very good. Please stay in your seats till we get up. Thank you very much.